You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Okay, welcome once again to the Avid Reader. We're going to continue with our efforts to have a new author every week, and this time we have Jen Bryant, who just published a book called The Fortune of Carmen Navarro. We're going to be talking to her about that book in just a moment. I think you'll really enjoy listening to her. She's a local author. The book contains references to places you all know, the Valley Forge Military Academy, King of Prussia, and a lot of other local areas that I think will resonate with all of you. So in just a moment, we'll be back, and we'll be spending some time with Jen Bryant talking about her new book, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro.
Hi, this is Ron McNeil, and I host one of the most popular radio shows in Chester County between the hours of 10 a.m. and noon, Monday through Friday. It's called Ron's Swap Shop, and it's designed for you, the listening audience, who might have something around the house to sell, buy, trade, or just give away. The great part of the show is that it's all free. It doesn't cost you anything to list your things on the radio show or on the website. Just call in WCHE at 610-701-9243 and describe your items to me. I'll then post them free of charge on our website, WCHE1520.com, where they'll stay up there for a full 2 weeks. Remember the times, 10 a.m. till noon, Monday through Friday. Call 610-701-9243.
The Avid Reader is pleased to have with us Jen Bryant, a Caldecott winner and a children's writer who has dabbled in many different forms of writing, including verse, illustrated books, and novels, both historical and otherwise. And she has a new book that was just published entitled The Fortune of Carmen Navarro. And welcome, Jen. How are you doing?
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I just finished the book, and I found it fascinating. And if you could tell us a little bit about the background, I think it would help our listeners to understand how this book came about.
Sure. Well, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro is a novel in four voices, and it's based on the original novella, a longer short story that was originally written by Prosper Mérimée, who's a French author, in the mid-1800s. And then it was made into an opera, music by Georges Bizet, and I think most people are familiar with one or the other, usually the opera. But I grew up in a small New Jersey town, and yet my parents were avid opera fans. And so this opera in particular, as a young child, just seemed charged with energy and emotion and romance. And I would always ask my parents, when they played the records, you know, what's the story behind it, what's happening, because it was always in a foreign language. This one's sung in French. And, you know, the character of Carmen just appealed to me so much. She was a renegade, outlaw, gypsy. She was a smuggler. And, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, there weren't very many sort of rebellious, in-charge women, and her character was just so exotic and different. I was drawn to her. I didn't know at the time, obviously, that I would grow up and become a young adult author and a poet and all of that. But I find that things from the distant past often come up as good material. And when it was time to start another book, I approached my editor at Random House and said, you know, how about a young adult novel based on that original story? And she said, yeah, go for it.
So, and the interesting thing is it still translates well into the same teenage angst that's pretty much ubiquitous around the world,
right,
and especially in America at this time. So I thought that was very good that especially since it's for young adults, they can relate to the boy-girl romance, boy loses girl, and in this specific case, dealing with obsession, which is difficult for both young girls and young boys.
Sure, sure. And I, you know, that first love is always, it's so intense. And, you know, this is the male character, Ryan, who is the military cadet. You know, he hasn't had a lot of experience with girls, and, you know, he just falls so hopelessly in love with her. And so that's a very specific story between the two of them. And yet, as you pointed out so correctly, I think everyone finds himself at some point on one or the other end of a relationship that is uneven. And so on that level, it's a universal emotional experience. And that's, you know, what I tried to tap into, even though I was telling a specific story about two characters.
You know, I was interested in the fact that you began each chapter, or most chapters, with a quote from Prosper. And that reminded me to ask you, and I think you've told it a number of times, let me ask you again, is what authors influenced you? Obviously, this story, Before the Opera, interested you.
Right.
But what other writers have you relied on for inspiration in your career?
You know, it would take me a year to
give me three or four of them then.
Yeah. Oh my. But I'll give you a few. You know, early on, I read a lot of creative nonfiction and essays. In particular, Annie Dillard is a creative nonfiction writer and essayist. She's also written poems and a novel. But her creative nonfiction, she's from Pittsburgh. And she wrote a memoir called Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. She's written a long essay on being a writer called The Writing Life. She writes in prose primarily, but it's so poetic and so good. I think she was one of the first writers who, you know, made the top of my head come off, like Emily Dickinson said. Emily Dickinson is another one. Her poetry is so charged and so intense and has those wonderful New England kind of hymn rhythms to it. It never gets old. Barbara Kingsolver, the novelist, wonderful, and she's written novels in several different voices, and that was that was a great inspiration for me to try that first in my Scopes Trial novel, Ringside 1925, and then again in this novel, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro.
Well, you know, with regard to the historical novels, and I guess all of your books, this is a current question that I even read an article about it today, mm-hmm. with regard to the upcoming Christmas season. What do you think about the translation of readership, especially young people, from the book to things like the Kindle and the Nook and other electronic devices? Are you ambivalent about it, or do you have a specific opinion?
You know, I'm trying to remain neutral because there have been these shifts all along in my lifetime. Again, I mentioned, you know, I grew up before the internet and before a lot of TV channels. And yet I still listen. You know, I love radio. I think there's a huge audience for radio, and that's a form that's been around for a long, long time, since the Lindbergh trial.
Yeah, I always analogize it to, when the incandescent light bulb first came out. The Candlemakers Union was up in arms saying, you know, this is dangerous, don't buy it, it's expensive, it'll blow up your house.
Right, exactly.
Based on that, the candle shouldn't exist, but the candle's everywhere. Every restaurant, every house, people light candles, and, you know, they're all over the place. But there really isn't any practical reason for them to exist. I think it's simply because people like them.
You know, that's a great analogy. I think... I will always have a love for the made thing, the book, and my guess is the craftsmanship that goes into the made thing, a book that is made from paper or paper products that you can put on your lap and read aloud to a child. I'm not sure that will ever really go away, and there may even be a nostalgia. There may be a movement back to the book. Just as, you know, we still go to see Broadway musicals and live theater, even though we can download a movie on our laptop. So, you know, I think everyone's in a kind of wait-and-see mode, the challenge being what part of the pie is each of these technologies, because the book is a technology, and but then also an e-reader is, and they seem to be constantly updating those, and they're more expensive. So you get into
the cool thing
economic
is that
issues.
The cool thing is that, you know, yes, it's technology, but it's 500-year-old technology, and the Gutenberg press and movable type.
Right.
Just like the Dewey Decimal System could easily translate to a computer, but it's a pretty good invention, and I think the tactile experience is wonderful. Of course, I'm plugging my own bookstore.
Right.
Oh, by the way, so you're gonna be appearing at our bookstore soon, right?
Yes, I am. The day after Thanksgiving, on Friday, November 26th, I will be at the Wellington Square bookshop from 1 to 3 p.m. signing my Caldecott Honor picture book, A River of Words, and my other picture books, and my new novel, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro, and my previous novel. So everything will be there, and I'm really looking forward to that, and hope we have a good crowd.
Yeah, I think it'll be an excellent turnout, and in the past we've really enjoyed having you there as well. And it's great that you're local, because when you read the book, tell me to stop if I'm giving stuff away. But, you know, you're dealing with King of Prussia, you're dealing with Valley Forge,
right.
You're dealing with a lot of local areas that people are going to really, especially the local readership, are really going to resonate to. I would say that the convenience store is really barred from a specific convenience store that's, I guess, local to the communities in the Northeast. Would that be correct?
Yeah, sure. It's a kind of generic place, and I had to... you know, as most writers will do, that base things on partly on things that they know and people they know and events that have actually happened, and yet it's tweaked to fit the needs of the story. But yeah, they're the two male characters, who are two of the four main narrators, are at the Valley Forge Military Academy, right here in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. You know, they take the shuttle bus to King of Prussia Mall. The convenience store is based on, you know, a somewhat of a tweaked 7-Eleven or Wawa or Quick Stop or something. And yet all of those details, you know, some of them are real true to life, and others are molded a little bit to fit the needs of the plot and the characters. But it's definitely set in a local setting, and setting is very, very, very important to me. I really feel like characters and honest to God, real people, you know, grow from where they are, and they're formed by where they come from, whether we like that or not, or we'll admit to it or not. I think it's a big part of our personality and our inclinations and our opinions. So I usually put a lot of stock in where something is set, and this one, being local, was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, it's like... Al Sebold and the Lovely Bones, and I think also it's easier for you, and also I guess somewhat nostalgic, almost like the smell of burning leaves, for you to be writing about localities that you're intimately familiar with, whether the local readership or the worldwide readership is looking at the book, because it's clear that it's something that's close to your heart.
You know, absolutely, and it's funny you should say that, because I was listening on the radio to an interview at the Toronto Film Festival. Bruce Springsteen was saying he is also from a small town in New Jersey, and I mean,
Asbury
think of
Park.
And I'm not equating myself to Bruce Springsteen at all, but just the creative process, how universal something can become from something very, very, very specific. And sometimes when I'm writing about something specific, like the Lindbergh baby kidnapping trial, which took place in my hometown of Flemington, New Jersey, in which my grandmother was alive to see, or Pieces of Georgia, which is a novel that's set in the Longwood Chads Ford area and has scenes in the Brandywine River Museum. I'm thinking, wow, this is really, you know, specific, and yet it ends up being appreciated by young people all across the country. I get letters from California and Utah, and it gets on reading lists in Nebraska and Maine, and it's that's the part of the kind of the mystery of writing, I think, is that you can write about something very near and dear to your own heart, and yet if you work at it hard enough, it becomes kind of a universal story.
And the cool thing is you can lie. That's the thing that people don't realize is you're allowed to lie in a book.
Yeah.
And that makes it so much easier once you accept that.
Right.
Let me ask you a couple silly questions that I guess I derive from some of the material I've read about you. In one of your interviews, you indicate that one of the books that really inspired you was Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss, which is a problem for me since my name is Sam.
Right.
I constantly get references to it till I'm really sick. But tell me, why was that particular book something that you really liked, and how did it inspire you?
Oh, you know, it was funny and clever. With, you know, all those exact rhymes as a very young child in all of his books, but in that one in particular, you could memorize whole chunks of it, which made you feel very powerful, you know, as a pre-reader. I couldn't yet decipher those squiggles on the page, but if I listened to my mother or my father or my grandmother read it to me, you know, I could keep chunks of it in my head and recite it back, and that was, you know, that was a very powerful sort of pre-writing, pre-reading feeling. And interestingly enough, similar to the Carmen, and until you asked me this question, Sam, I didn't make this connection, but there's a kind of, you know, bullheaded rebelliousness in that story. Here, do you want this? No, I don't. You know, so it's, as a kid, it's kind of appealing to dig in, because kids are, you know, they're at the mercy of the adult world for such a long time, and for this character to be saying, I do not like them, you know, I do not. And then at the end, of course, yes, I do. You know, just that rebelliousness a little is appealing to a kid, and I'm sure that did appeal to me.
And also, you know, sometimes I don't like it in books when one chapter is devoted to the past and then there's a contemporary figure. But this book, each section is all for the characters, then all for the characters again, then all for the characters again. And you always do something unusual like that in your writing, I've noticed. But this really kept your interest, and you didn't say, oh, I wish I could read about Brian instead of Maggie.
Right.
Each person's viewpoint of the same incident, I think, made it fascinating.
Well, you know, I appreciate your saying that. I'm actually headed to the National Council of Teachers of English conference this coming weekend in Orlando, Florida, and I'm actually doing a session with Professor John Moore from William & Mary, and he's talking about, you know, in academic terms, they call that postmodern elements. And of course, I don't sit down and say I'm going to write a postmodern novel. I just sit down and write the novel. But the telling of a story from various points of view is, you know, academically speaking, technically speaking, something that is not as traditional. And yet, for me, I think it's more true to life. We're looking at, you know, Thanksgiving, where you sit down and you recount things from the past. And how often have all of us sat around that table or you know, talked to a relative we haven't seen in a while, and you both think back to a family event, a gathering, a wedding, and you have totally different versions of that, and yet you were maybe standing next to each other.
Yeah,
so
that's,
I think that's how we process reality, and that's why I think the multiple narration works for readers. You know, as long as you can keep those voices consistent, it's consistent with reality.
Well, you know, I was thinking about what you were saying about Thanksgiving dinner and going home. And discussing what really are alternate histories. And what I'm going to try and do on the show sometimes is kind of do the Proust questionnaire that, not Esquire, Vanity Fair does every month.
Okay.
So let me ask you some of those questions, and some of them are flippant, and some of them you might not be happy to answer. I would be reluctant or reticent on some of them too. But a couple of them would be this. What is the happiest moment you've spent in your life or had in your life, and has that affected anything that you've written about?
You know, wow, and it's funny, I'm always interested in the next thing. I'm not someone that kind of hangs my hat on Kodak moments. My family will tell you this too, although I do remember them and I have them, and I draw a lot on my memory and experiences. You know, one of them, when, as soon as I hear that question, of course, the birth of my daughter in November of 1988, she's 22 now, is definitely one of those. The Day I Was Married, definitely one of those. You know, anytime you're adding people to your life who enrich it and support it and add love, that's got to be one of your happiest moments. I have a happy period that I would share with you. When I was a teenager, I spent a lot of time on a horse farm in New Jersey on the weekends, and it's funny, in times of stress, I will often dream of the barn and the horse paths and just the, it was in some way, I think it helped to make me a writer in a way I couldn't have known at the time, but there's just so much sensory imagery in the natural world and particularly on a farm that I think it had a quieting effect on me and maybe kept me out of trouble too because there was a lot of physical work and being out of doors and
it's like what you were saying in the same interview is that what you like to do is to wander aimlessly. And
yes.
My question was, is that in your mind? Is that traveling? Is it both? What do you mean exactly by that?
Yeah. Well, I have a particular affinity for sidewalks. Any place that has a sidewalk that's not a designed sidewalk, but it's a natural outgrowth of community. The town of Westchester, where you are right now, I mean... I love the sense of community being right outside of your private sphere. Whereas in the suburbs, I live in the woods in northern Chester County, and it's lovely. I love it. I've come to embrace this landscape, but I grew up in a town whereby, you open the front door and you are in your community. And the sense of community in a town like Westchester, my daughter and I were recently in Providence, Rhode Island, and I spent what little free time I have just kind of exploring on foot with a map from the hotel and just discovering. And the sense of discovery that you can have, I think because I grew up pre-internet and pre-9/11 perhaps as a child, I had a lot of freedom to discover my own landscape. And I'm not sure kids do that nowadays, and that also helped to make me a writer. So,
well, it's really hard to do it nowadays because
yeah.
Out in LA, I think I read a statistic that 90-some% of LA is covered with asphalt.
Yes.
So, and if you're walking in LA, the cops will stop you and ask you why you're walking.
That's right.
Whereas, two things I would note: Eagle View, where the bookstore is located,
yes.
tries to recapture that thing,
yes.
where a porch is located within 10 feet of the next porch. So you almost have to make neighbors. You almost have to make friends.
That's right.
And when I went to high school, they were going to make a sidewalk, and what they did was they waited. They waited until people walked the way people walk, and when they saw what the path was, they said, "Oh, that's where the sidewalk will go."
Yeah, how smart is that?
It was great.
Yep.
Well.
And that pretty much describes the writing process, too. I mean, at least the way I do it, I don't outline it. It's organic, and I wait and see where the images and the emotion goes, and then it's more of a following. It's not passive, per se, but it's kind of almost a more of a zen way of doing it, I guess, rather than saying, here's point A, point B, point C, and I have to connect the dots somehow. It's a... slow unfolding of a path.
Yeah, it's kind of a random walk, and I think if you have a story, your analogy is another great analogy. I think if you have a story and you just wander back and forth through it,
yes.
eventually you create your sidewalk, which is what you like.
Right, exactly. And the challenge being, I think, to be able to recognize where the sidewalk is and to discard the other paths. That's the thing. I mean, I think a lot of beginning writers that I work with in workshops and whatnot, it's just so too painful for them to discard any option. But I think that's really essential. You have to come back to your original scribblings with your more disciplined editor's hat on and say, you know what, this part's working, but this one's not. And you end up throwing out, big chunks of writing, but then what's left is stronger for it.
Well, one of the parts of this show, well, the main part of the show that I hate is that it has to end. And we've been talking now for half an hour, and I wish I had signed up for an hour program. And maybe I will change it, because I could go on and on. I find this fascinating. But in closing, I guess, okay, you're going to be at Wellington this weekend. If you have anything else you want to basically plug, do it now.
Oh, well, thanks so much. This coming weekend, November 26th, Friday, from 1 to 3, I'll be at Wellington Square Books in Eagleview, and they have a wonderful website. So if you just Google Wellington Square Bookshop, Exton, you'll find it. And I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of folks there. And I'm going to take some time off in the snowy months and try and churn out a new book. So I'm also looking forward to that, and then I'll be back on the road a little bit again in the spring.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jen. I will talk to you soon. I'll see you this weekend, and I think the book, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro, is an excellent read. I couldn't put it down. I read it in one sitting, and I would recommend it to almost anybody, adult or young adult or tween or whatever. So thanks again for appearing here, and we'll talk again soon.
Well, thank you so much, Sam. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. See ya.
So this was great talking to Jen Bryan about her new book, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did too. I learned a lot about her, and if you look back, especially mothers who have young children, if you look back at some of her other books, I think you'll find, especially she's a local Caldecott winner, and that's a very prestigious award to win with regard to children's books. And next time, I hope we will have some time for call-ins, but some of the authors we speak to are we're talking to them from Paris, France, or other distant localities, so it makes it difficult to call in those situations. But we also expect within the next couple of weeks to have Paul Harding on the show. He's the gentleman who wrote Tinkers, and that, as some of you may know, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel that was rejected by about 20 different publishers. So all of your aspiring novelists out there, don't give up when you send off your manuscript. In fact, it was expected that it would sell so little that it was never even published in hardback. It went directly to paperback. It was never even published in hardback form because, as I said, so few of the books were expected to be sold. But then when the Pulitzer Prize jury met, they reviewed the book and found it, as did I, not only fascinating, but crafted beautifully. It's not often that I go back and read a paragraph twice. Generally, I'm too lazy. But in this situation, the writing was so well crafted, and each word kind of jigsawed into the other, that you couldn't help but read it back, not because you didn't understand it the first time, but because it was so beautiful that you had to read it again. And as I said, hopefully he'll be here in the next couple of weeks. And the other really cool thing is that we're going to have the translator of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trilogy. Obviously, we can't have the author because he is unfortunately deceased. But the translator will be with us of the Stieg Larsson trilogy. And I think he did an excellent translation. I know because I asked a bunch of Swedish people if they could read the English one for me, and they all agreed that it was very true to the original Swedish editions. In any event, I hope you enjoyed this edition of The Avid Reader.
We've been listening to Jen Bryan discussing her new book, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro, and Jen will be at our store, Wellington Square Bookshop, from 1 to 3 p.m., on November 26th, Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of the year, signing books such as A River of Words, her story of William Carlos Williams, The Trial, which is a story of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, and also her new book, The Fortune of Carmen Navarro. So we hope you join us there at our bookstore in Eagleview in the town center, just above the Brickside Restaurant, and we hope you'll also listen in at the next edition of The Avid Reader. Thanks. See you soon.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.